Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Solaria Report a man who truly needs no introduction, Dr. Joseph Farrell, and he comes to us fresh from finishing a wonderful new book, which is one of the many things we're going to talk about. But our topic tonight is the Bilderbergers, and one of the reasons we're meeting is the Bilderbergers are meeting in Austria starting yesterday and going till the 14th, and so Joseph and I are having our own meeting.
That's good.
We're here to make some policy decisions. No, ours is a broadcast. Right. We're the other side of the coin. Okay, so Bilderbergers, where I want to start, I don't even want to start with the Bilderbergers. I want to start, Joseph, with your wonderful first presentation at the Secret Space Program Conference. We put a link up to it on the blog post, and of course it's been public for a while now. But what you did is you went back and you took us from the ending of World War II and the collection of piles of loot that started a hidden system of finance. So let's start back there at the end of World War II. What happened to the Nazis and what happened to their money?
Well, first of all, it's important for folks to understand that at the surrender of the Third Reich in 1945, there was no representative at either formal surrender of the Reich government itself, which at the time was Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz, and there was no representative of the Nazi Party. And that's, to me, a very huge point, because the Allies had the perfect opportunity to insist that somebody be there signing on behalf of the Nazi Party and basically signing it as a criminal organization and banning further existence. This was not done. So if you go back to circa 1943 after Stalingrad, the Nazi hierarchy is laying plans for a long-term strategic evacuation of capital. And the way they're defining capital, I think, here is very important to understand. It's not only liquid assets, it's not only bullion and so on, securities and stocks and so on, but it's also patents, it's technicians, scientists, personnel. They're getting as much of this out of the country as they can. And, of course, they're sitting on top of just an enormous pile of loot. I even heard recently that Martin Bormann, toward the end of the war, controlled something like $20 billion in 1945 dollars. So that's a huge pile of cash. And they've got to move it out of the country, which, of course, they're doing by a variety of means, physical transfer of bullion and jewels and things like that as much as they can out of Europe or into the Bank of International Settlements quite often, which then transfers on accounts to other banks around the world. So that's a huge part of the story. And the other thing they're doing, of course, is they're moving a lot of cash into front companies and corporations and so on. And I got to thinking, Catherine, years ago about the Bilderberger Group, because if you look at the founding of it in 1954, you have, of course, the Rothschilds in Great Britain involved with this. You have Lawrence and David Rockefeller in this country, of course, involved in the founding. But on the European side of things, I thought it was very peculiar that you had Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands being one of the major movers and shakers. And that raised huge suspicions. I mean, it put my suspicion meter into the red zone, let's put it that way, because this fellow was at one time a manager in IG Farben. And if you look at the early attendees at those Bilderberger meetings, you had as a consistent presence one Dr. Hermann Josef Ops, who was at that time the CEO of Deutsche Bank. During the war, as I pointed out during the Secret Space Conference, he was the head of a small handling bank in Berlin that was the bank that handled all public accounts of the Reich government. So in other words, this was the fellow that was signing Adolf Hitler's paycheck as Reichskanzler. So, you know, this kind of signaled to me that what we may be looking at is really a coordinating body to manage the movement of all of these funds that the Nazis had available into Western banks, where they'd then be kept off the books as kind of a secret reserve, that they'd be used by the Americans to fund covert operations, black projects, research, and then, of course, some of that money funneled back into Europe in the form of American aid, with the bankers getting their cut all along the way. So that's what, to me, I think the Bilderberger Group starts out as.
Well, I also want to mention one other thing from the war. We have a lot of documentation to prove that there was a governance structure. When you and I talked the last time about the Nazis, right, I called it the meta-government. But there was a structure coordinating back and forth between the Americans and the Nazis, you know, simply like a holding company above both of them. So if you read Charles Higgins' wonderful book, Trading with the Enemy, we see the U.S. essentially ordered at a level above the White House, to produce manufactured goods and ship them to the Nazis so we could keep the war going. And but we also see Dulles in Switzerland laundering money back and forth. But I think that one of the great books on the war is Edwin Black's book on IBM and the Holocaust. We have IBM basically building and operating the databases that manage the Holocaust.
Yes.
Because there's an enormous database operation if you're going to round up and slaughter, you know, or use a slave labor, 8 million people.
Right.
So, you know, it's almost as though there is a transnational corporation structure above the sovereign governments that's coordinating and managing the war.
Yes.
And, you know, we see glimpses of it, but we've never seen it clearly. And go ahead.
If I can interrupt there, this, you're raising one of the most crucial, vital points for people to understand. In this new book, and incidentally, I just heard from my publisher today, and he said that the book is already at the printer.
Ooh, goody.
And it may be out sometime in mid-July, so I'll keep you and your listenership posted on that. But one of the things I uncovered, Catherine, in researching this latest book, I kind of did this in response to questions I kept getting from people ever since Nazi International came out. Well, where is the Nazi International today? Where is it located and what's it doing? And the bad news is, as far as I can tell, it's located in Europe and they're up to the same old things. But during the war, the Nazi government, under the chairmanship of Walter Funk, who succeeded Hjalmar Schacht as president of the Reichsbank, sponsored a study in 1942, which was, you know, during the height of, you know, the high tide of the Axis powers. And this study, Catherine, was essentially a very detailed, very well thought out plan for a European federation and what they called a Großraum cartel, a large space cartel. And, you know, that choice of language says it all, because what the planning involves is a lot of people from Farben, a lot of people from German finance, a lot of people from the Nazi Party, figuring out, well, how are we going to, you know, rule this, all of this conquest that we've got. And they decide on essentially two points here. They're going to keep it a kind of corporate fascist state with large cartels like Farben running this thing. And they're going to amalgamate law through regulation and through bureaucracy and just completely bypass any national legislatures or regional legislatures and so on. And if you look at the structure of the post-war European Union, and particularly the people involved in setting it up, what you have at almost every turn is you have Nazis that were either in the propaganda ministry or in the Ministry of the Interior, or the finance ministries and so on, involved in setting up the West German government and involved in setting up the European coal and steel community, the first stages along the way to the common market and then later the Eurozone and so on. You have collaborators in France, Vichy collaborators, one of whom turns out to be President François Mitterrand. So, you know, you've got all of these people involved in setting up these post-war structures. And again, to me, that argues very strongly that we have a context here for the Bilderberg meetings, that what they're doing is they're setting up a vast coordinating body, like you say, a transnational corporate cartel trust entity of some sort that's going to keep all this running.
Well, it's interesting, when Bilderberg first started, it may have been the coordinating body for the loot.
Right.
But as time gone by, I sort of see the executive committee as disappearing into the, you know, into the background.
Yes,
and
too. Yeah.
Yeah, increasingly over time, what you're seeing is people who run a staff or, you know, deputy function to those people.
Right.
Who get together and coordinate. And of course, the more public attention that it becomes, the lower the level of staff that shows up
right.
at the meetings.
Right.
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 Yeah.
But I still think there's a role here, looking at the latest Bilderberg invitation list. I've noticed some very interesting things. You have some people, you have typical representatives. Deutsche Bank is always there for some reason, and that tells me a lot right there. Royal Dutch Shell, but then you have all of these lower echelon intelligence people, and
right.
Yeah, so it's looking like it's transitioned itself from a high-level coordinating body into kind of the middle management conference.
Well, that's what happened to the Council on Foreign Relations. They, you know, the executive committee was sort of the group, and then you got this wider and wider group that was almost, I don't know, like fluff surrounding, so that you made it look much more like a think tank and a policy discussion as opposed to real decision-making. But if you looked at the executive committee, there was clearly some decision-making going on.
Right. It's definitely transitioned to being more of a think tank, a policy discussion group, as you say. I think in terms of what we're looking at, as far as my hypothesis, that in the immediate post-war period, it was kind of a high-level coordinating body. I think by the end of the chancellorship of Konrad Adenauer, and then the transition to some of the post-war chancellors from Ludwig Erhard on up to probably including Willy Brandt, that's the period that the Bilderberger group begins to transition into more of this kind of middle echelon management thing, because by that point they have set up most of the post-war transnational European economic zones, the coal and steel community, the common market, and so on and so forth. Those things are in place. And it's about that era that we see the Bilderberg group begin to transition to what we see today.
Right. Okay, so let's tie in the money on the black budget, because first we have this sort of secret loot, if you will, and we have an integration back into Europe and the United States of many of the people involved.
Right.
In the Nazi effort. So you have Operation Paperclip, and we've covered that in prior Salieri reports. But then you leverage that hidden loot with the black budget.
Right.
So what I went through in my talk at the Secret Space Program conference is, you know, how the black budget got added, what it was involved, how it levered, and the combination of those two things. And I think one of the most important points that I want to keep making is one you made, which is, what that process did was turn intelligence agencies into the most powerful bankers on the planet.
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is such a crucial thing that I really to this day don't think that many people quite understand the significance of it, and particularly in American politics. You spoke
right.
during your talk of the importance of Sullivan and Cromwell and the group that kind of hovers in and around that law firm, the Dulles brothers, you know, Averill Harriman, people like this, that are connected to that group. And you see that group at almost every turn during the war. And I do get into this a bit in the book. You see that group involved during the war in trying to maintain the Bank of International Settlements and its diplomatic immunity. vis-a-vis the United States, because at the time, of course, the BIS was headed by an American who was traveling all over Axis Europe under BIS diplomatic passport. You know, that tells you a lot right there, you know. But, you know, this fellow, his name was Thomas McKittrick, and this fellow was very, very well connected to John Foster and to Allen Dulles, and therefore to Sullivan and Cromwell. So he represents this faction within, and I hope that people really understand this point, he represents this faction within the post-war American intelligence finance community that has clearly its own communications and access to all of this post-war Axis loot. They have clearly a nexus with post-war German intelligence, with General Galen. So they're very well situated. And then you brought out something very important, that a lot of this money made its way into, I believe it was the Exchange Stabilization Fund that you pointed
right
out. And that's a crucial thing here, because what it means is you have basically lawyers and technocrats that are now put into the business of international banking, and doing it in such a way that they have to have the participation in order to make this black budget hidden system work. They have to have the participation of most of the major prime banks in the Western world at some level. Although I want to stress something here that also confuses people. I think the participation of those banks is at a lower level. In other words, they're sort of,
right,
again, the middle echelon managers to make this thing work. I don't think that you can charge, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase or Citibank or all of these banks with complicity at a high level. It's more that certain aspects of their departments are going to be penetrated by the intelligence agencies and so on.
Well, but they're implementing orders. They're not inventing,
right,
policy. They're implementing policy.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Right.
The policy implementation is going to be coming out of, I think, you know, since we're talking about the Bilderbergers, I think the policy implementation, particularly for financial matters, is going to be coming out of quiet, you know, unannounced discussion groups, you know, these personal nexuses that exist in law firms like Sullivan and Cromwell, and then their connections to the State Department and their connections to Wall Street and to the various banks, to the Federal Reserve, to the Exchange Stabilization Fund. Policy is going to be set there, out of the limelight. And
right,
they're going to coordinate with groups like the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, Bilderberg Group. What I think those groups end up becoming are sounding boards. They're pulse takers, that they get these people together and they talk about all these issues. That gives them pretty much a good sense of the pulse and the direction that things are headed. But I don't think that those groups anymore are the real decision-making centers. I hope that's making some sense. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think behind the Bilderbergers, there are some real decision-makers.
Yeah.
Who use that process to collect and build consensus. I think,
right,
if you look at the executive committee and who's behind them and the CFR, those are real decision makers. I think there's real decision makers who show up at the Bohemian Grove and use,
right,
that as a process to, you know, but what you're looking at is you're looking between all of them at holding cross sector conversations,
exactly,
that allow consensus to be developed and built.
Well, there's another aspect that we,
right,
that we need to introduce here, I think, that will buttress this idea that these groups are no longer the actual decision-making bodies, but rather the consensus-building and the pulse-taking bodies. And that is simply the Internet and the huge amount of financial trading that's now done electronically. So in other words, access to that data provides the real intelligence, and access to that data is in the hands of the intelligence agencies, not necessarily the banks, although they would certainly, larger banks would have access to it, a lot of it, but not all.
Right.
So I think, again, we have to look at the intelligence agencies, GCHQ in Great Britain, BND in Germany, you know, NSA in this country, and so on.
Well, I would say it's data and the ability to kill with impunity.
That too, yeah, absolutely.
Right,
that
so
too.
It's the combination.
And there, you know, again, going back to my Nazi International hypothesis, certainly that group, any criminal underground like that is going to kill with impunity and has the network and means to do so, as do the intelligence agencies. So you're looking at a real multi-headed hydra, a real monster when it comes right down to it. And they're going to do anything to...
Go ahead.
No, well, they're going to do anything to protect this hidden system of finance, because that's where the real money is. That's where the real ownership of things is. But anyway, that was all I had to say really on it.
You when you watch how the U.S. economy was centralized, what you see is the build out of what I call the control file network.
Right.
Which you always had. So, for example, one of the reasons the Catholic Church was so powerful is, you know, they had everybody coming in once a week and confessing.
Right, exactly.
You know, it was the storefront version. But you see the control file system getting built out, and drive becoming more and more invasive and much more tightly controlled. And then in the 80s, with the development of telecommunications, you really see a push. And suddenly, that whole process puts this network that we're talking about in the catbird seat.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think it's very – I'll never forget when I moved here to Tennessee and I went to put – I had $6,000 in cash. I went to put it in a safe deposit box at the local bank. And the president of the bank, who I'd never met, suddenly sees me coming in to go to the box, jumps up, tears over, and tries to look over my shoulder and see what I'm putting in the box.
Oh my.
And I realized, you know, if the boys in Washington can produce this result in a week, you know, then the networking is very tight.
Yes.
Yeah. Which of course it is. Well, anyway, so I wanted to bring up some of the more recent meetings, because right after 9/11, as everyone was screaming about security, and, you know, everything's dangerous, the Bilderbergers met right in Washington, and no one was worried about security.
Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting sign. And if you look at who was at that meeting, there was a fair amount of players. But then there's the very famous meeting in 2008 when Obama and Clinton disappeared for a day and came back best of friends. And, of course, the word was the Bilderbergers had informed Obama he had it. But Clinton clearly had been paid off very well.
Right.
And seemed to be quite happy was the interpretation of events. And I believe that that's probably true.
Yeah, I do, too.
Right.
They are in the position, and again, this takes me back to the research I did for this new book. They clearly want to control any sort of democratic process that they can, and put their people into play where they are able to do so, which is pretty much everywhere these days. And what they can't accomplish doing that, they accomplish through their control of government and regulatory bureaucracies. This again is all spelled out in 1942 in those documents that I uncovered researching this book. So this is their chosen method. It doesn't surprise me at all to see these people handpicking and selecting their presidential or prime minister or chancellor candidates.
Well, it's interesting to go back. The money that they originally put in the exchange stabilization fund that the Dulles brothers were managing before the CIA got created,
right,
was being used to rig European elections at the request of the Vatican.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The famous case there is 1948, the 1948 elections, where Pius XII at the time was very concerned about the growth of and strength of communist parties in Italy. And they showed great strength going into that election. And there was a slush fund established. They moved money from the exchange stabilization fund and other sources into the Vatican Bank. And that, in turn, was money that was used to fund the Italian parties running against the communists and defeat them in that election. So, yeah, this, it's a huge war chest is what it amounts to.
There's a song I love from Leonard Cohen, and I'm always quoting it to you. The line says, "First we take Manhattan, then we take Berlin."
Yep.
The implication being that Nazis lose the war, create Nazi International, take over the United States, then go back and take Europe.
Exactly. And again, I have to say, when I did this research for this new book, I was rather dumbfounded, Catherine, that the German war aims in World War I and World War II were very consistent. They were trying to create a post-war, basically a post-war European federation in each case that would be dominated by Germany and dominated by the Reichsmark, or as it turned out after the war, the Deutschmark. This was always in their plans. And it's spelled out very explicitly. So today we see nothing new, and that does put the Bilderbergers into a rather interesting light.
Well, it's funny. You almost wonder, well, the metastructure tried to use the Nazis to get it done, and that didn't work. So they used, you know, they just reconfigured and used somebody else to get it done.
Yep, that's right. Exactly. That's right.
Okay, so obviously the question is, who is this? But let me bring up something else. Last night I interviewed Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, who is the 15th most senior member in the House. So this is, I believe, her 15th term. And she represents the northern tip of Ohio from Toledo over along the lakes. And she's exceptionally intelligent, very hardworking, very capable. So this is a very experienced congresswoman. And we're going to use the picture for the blog post for her to read the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She had to sign a secrecy document, go into a controlled room where she was allowed to read 1,000 pages. Her staff was not allowed to read it.
Oh.
Okay. So she had to read it personally. She's not allowed to tell her constituents what's in it that would affect them, or else she's subject to criminal prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember, the staffs of different CEOs have been allowed to read it.
Right.
And so, and if you look at what's in it, the majority of it does not relate to trade agreements. The majority relates to reengineering the fundamental relationship between corporations and sovereign governments. So it's literally a reengineering, of the Constitution by backdoor means. Now, I don't believe it's constitutional. I don't believe the Congress has the ability to give the president the ability to arbitrarily, you know, invoke a constitutional change.
Yes.
So I don't believe the president can do that, and I don't believe the Congress has the power to give him that power. So, so this is an entirely, as far as I'm concerned, illegal proposal. And yet we have 7 prior secretaries of the Treasury signing a letter that it's absolutely imperative that this get passed.
Right.
If you look at the sort of the political process that's going on in Europe around, let me step back. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is essentially the G7 members that touch the Pacific Ocean. Then you have the Transatlantic Partnership, which is the G7 plus, in both cases, plus others, but it's really the G7 driving it, you know, that touch the Atlantic. And they're trying to do both of those, as well as a third trade agreement called the Trade and Service Act, which, in fact, no one is allowed to read. There's no 1,000-page document. You can't get in and see that one, apparently, yet. That's very secret. You see huge opposition. The European Union just delayed debate on the transatlantic one. Apparently, there's a petition with 2 million Europeans having signed it. You know, sort of society in Europe is up in arms.
Right.
So what we've got is basically 3 documents that, from everything we can tell, is basically a coup d'etat, you know,
yes,
presented as a trade agreement.
Yes.
You know, which is clearly illegal. you know, is in violation of all the laws of sovereign governments here and there.
Right.
And if you look at the pressure that's being used, let me give you an example. I think they knocked off Harry Reid by indicting another senator and threatening Reid with an indictment just to get him out of the way so they could do this. So I think the pressure that's being used by the intelligence agencies in this network, you know, because whatever this Hydra that we're talking about, coming out of the hidden system of finance, coming out of the Nazi money, coming out of Nazi International, coming out of the black budget, and I'm not trying to say it's one thing because I'm sure there are factions in different groups.
Right.
Whoever they are pushing for an entirely new plan for G7 governance.
Yes.
That is very radical.
Yes.
And they're trying to do it through these trade agreements.
Yes, absolutely. Let me put some historical perspective on that, because that I think you're absolutely right, and that fits the pattern that I discovered in researching this latest book. And if you go back to the plans that were laid by the Farben people, by the Nazi Party during World War II, one of the things that they stress is they're going to amalgamate law. They're going to amalgamate all these European patent and corporate laws through the establishment of a central European regulatory body that is going to simply bypass national legislatures and regulate on the basis of corporate diktat. And that's what we're seeing here. So in other words, they've taken this pattern that was going to be used to essentially create the structure of the European Union, and they're applying it globally. And this is what alarms me, because what they're doing, the title of this German document, as I indicated before, uses the phrase Großraum Kartell, large space cartel. So in other words, what they're doing is they're also, during the war, they're setting up not only these huge cartels, they're setting up these huge trusts. And this is what you see going on, I think, with these new trade agreements and the secrecy, because it's like you say, it's a coup d'etat. And what they're doing is my bet is, they're establishing central regulatory authorities, regional and continental regulatory authorities. And then the executive branches within each government are going to be more or less the local legal agent for that regulatory body. So that's the pattern that was there in these Nazi documents. This is the pattern, I think, that you're going to see in these new trade agreements.
Okay, so let's look at who's out, because it's basically the G7.
Right.
So if you look at the BRICS, if you look at Brazil, Russia, South Africa, India, China, they're not in.
Right. Right.
And so part of my question is the Nazi International trying to organize everything outside of India and China to make sure, you know, it's a bigger dog?
What's the game plan? What's the goal?
Yeah, because I've always believed Mr. Global likes to pit Plan A against Plan B.
Plan B, right.
Right. And clearly, whatever is going on in China and India, it's been financed by these folks.
Yes, absolutely. Part of it is, I suspect, that they've had to finance part of the BRICS operation simply because there is internal, and I hope I'm making sense here, there's internal opposition in those countries to the globalist dogma that the nation state is obsolescent,
right,
or obsolete. In other words, you're dealing particularly in those countries, particularly in the case of countries like China, with a long history of being treated badly by Western financial oligarchs, particularly in the 19th century. Same thing with India, and certainly with Russia. You look very hard to find people in high position within the Russian government today that buy into the globalist dogma that the nation state is completely obsolete. So they've had to finance this group of people to a certain extent because they cannot get them to buy into the dogma. So they're trying to extend, the way I look at it anyway, is they're trying to extend their influence in those countries by doing a certain amount of financing and by jumping on board China's new Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. I was stunned to see how quickly the European countries jumped on that bandwagon, to a certain extent because they're still so much under the thumb of Washington, and that to me is an indicator that they're trying both to gain influence, and they're also playing both ends against the middle because they also look at Washington as a declining power, and eventually they're going to have to deal much more directly with the Asian powers. So that's one thing. The other thing I think is going on is you do have this push for the obsolescence of the nation state. And this really rocked my boat, Catherine, when I was researching the latest book, because I discovered this dogma squatting right there in the middle of, mid-war Nazi plans, because it's very clear that the people doing the planning and the policy-making decisions are IG Farben and the Nazi Party. The governments of Europe, including the Reich government itself, only enter the picture at a much lower level of their considerations. So this dogma is definitely part of their scheming right from the start. So it looks to me like with these trade agreements and so on, they're trying to expand their realm. And the other thing they're trying to do is I think they're trying to solidify their power base for an eventual long-term game of confrontation with the BRICS nations. And I think the key there with that confrontation are going to be India and Brazil. And the reason I say that is that India, of course, has its own long history of not only animosity with the West, but animosity with China. And Brazil, by the same token, has, until very, very recently, been more or less under the thumb of the United States. So those are the nations we're going to have to watch very carefully and see what they do and how they treat some of these partnership agreements. They're going to kind of walk a middle course, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's interesting. If you look at one of the reasons I think the current batch of trade agreements has come up is because the WTO, we started with the WTO being created by the Uruguay round.
Right.
And then the next round was the Doha round, which has been stuck for years. The World Trade Organization has never been able to get another round done, and that's because 200,000 Indian farmers committed suicide, essentially stopping the Doha round.
Right, right.
So,
well, that, you know, part of this, again, we've talked about this, and this is a huge topic in and of itself. Part of this is the growing opposition to GMOs worldwide.
Right.
And India in particular was very, very hard hit by the Western GMO companies, and the resistance there is growing. It's as it is in Russia. China's kind of sitting on the fence, but I've maintained for a long time that if the BRICS bloc really wants to play some geopolitical hardball, they can target the GMO issue and start targeting international agriculture by making heirloom seeds, in other words, natural seeds, massively available on the world market. And,
right.
I still think that that's in the cards. I think eventually they're going to do this.
Right, and it'll be interesting because Europe is very opposed to GMO,
yeah.
The European population.
Yeah, the European population, and that's another indicator right there of brewing troubles in Europe, because the European population, all the way from Greece to Spain up through France and Germany, is opposed to many things going on. And you've got a central bureaucracy in Brussels that is not elected by any popular representation that responds basically to the diktats coming out of Paris and Berlin is what it does. And that's the regulatory body that I've been referring to that's making all these regulatory decisions and basically doing by regulation what legislative bodies normally do with law. So there's growing opposition to that phenomenon within the European Union. So it's going to be very interesting how this plays out. And the GMO issue is, you know, we both know that it's huge in Hungary, it's huge in Germany, it's huge in France, and I think it's only going to grow, especially as Russia has been increasingly against it. So I really look for the BRICS bloc to come up with some sort of international game plan, a consistent game plan with regard to GMOs, and go tit for tat with the big Western agribusiness.
Well, you know, Brazil is big GMO, so that's going to
Yeah, exactly. That's going to be another one of those touchy issues where Brazil is going to be on the fence.
Right.
It's going to be interesting to see if the BRICS bloc, with those tensions with India and Brazil, can hold itself together. What's holding it together now is simply opposition to the United States. But it's going to be interesting to see if this can turn into a more positive, consistent bloc of policy.
I'm going to be in Europe for 2 months in the fall. And one of the things I'm very curious to see is how the general population feels towards America. Because if you look at the problems that Europe is having as a result of everything we're doing in the Middle East and Ukraine, you know, they're being flooded and overwhelmed with refugees.
Yes.
And they've paid a very big price for our sanctioned policies, including sanctions against Russia.
Right.
And so if I were them, I would be very, you know, I would be inclined to an anti-American sentiment because, you know, if you look at what we've been up to around the world globally, I think part of the problem and one of the reasons Europe jumped on the Asian Infrastructure Bank is China's running around the world saying, let's build things, let's build railroads, let's build trains. And we're running around the world destroying things.
Yes,
and I think there's a general fury everywhere, including in the United States. You know, they're tired of seeing this kind of nihilistic destruction.
Yes, absolutely. This, you know, as I've said many times, the United States is in a war of the League of Cambrai moment. Our foreign policy has become so imperial and so unipolar. Ever since 9/11, really, but particularly in the last Bush administration and now into Obama, the backlash against it is getting to be overwhelming and quite popular. And this is not something that they're going to be able to ignore at these Bilderberg meetings. In fact, I was looking at that list of the current meeting, and one of the things that they want to talk about is European strategy, and that's above globalization. So in other words, it looks to me the way that the Bilderberg Society itself put it out on their website is they're responding to these internal pressures in Europe. And I think this is going to be a hot topic during their discussions this week. What to do, not so much about the BRICS bloc, but what to do about the United States. How do we rein it in? How do we draw back from this abyss that the United States seems to be embarked on in the Ukraine, in the Middle East, and so on and so forth? And again, there's another factor here that I think we need to look at, and that's Japan. Because, and we've talked about this before, Catherine, but Shinzo Abe and his rearmament scheme in Japan, I think, is on the surface, it's a response to pressures from Washington to take up a greater role in Pacific security matters.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
But in the long term, I think the more hidden objective of Mr. Abe's government, and I think he's reflecting a deep long-term decision that's been made in Tokyo by the Japanese elite, and that is simply that we can't keep ourselves hitched to America and be a satrapy forever. We're going to have to take up our own security and do so in such a way that if this big American empire collapses, we can defend ourselves and take care of our own interests in the Pacific. And the Europeans are going to be seeing the same thing. This is very clear. So what we're going to see, you know, over the long term, I don't know, but I think, yeah, you're right. I think you're absolutely right. We're going to see growing opposition to the course of foreign policy that we've been on. And there's a final factor I think we need to bear in mind here, and that was Mr. Kerry's recent trip to meet.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah. To me, Catherine, that looked like a sudden about face. That,
well, why don't we just step back and explain to people what happened? Let's go through the steps.
Okay.
Well, first, I won't get into the details of what Kerry said, but Kerry came out and took a series of positions towards a certain message towards the Ukraine government. And it wasn't that long after that his number two on the Ukraine policy, Victoria Nuland at State Department, came out and reversed him, presumably with the backing of the president. So Kerry got the rug pulled out from under him by his boss and his subordinate. And then shortly thereafter was bicycling in Switzerland.
Yep.
And was said to have hit a curb and then broken his leg, which makes no sense. I mean, I'm a biker. And I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but it's doesn't make sense. You know, it's not a story that makes sense. And I don't think anybody's seen him since.
No.
He seems to have just disappeared.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what I will tell you is, Kerry is one of the few people in this administration I have real respect for. I'm not trying to say he's perfect, and I'm not trying to say I agree with him on everything, but this is a guy who's always been very grounded and hardworking. And he's, you know, to use your expression, he's a guy who functions on 28 tracks.
Right.
Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I do. And I would add to that I'm like you. I'm very suspicious of this accident. An experienced biker doesn't ride into curbs. it makes me think that maybe somebody may have thinned down his brake pads or something like this.
No, you know how you do it? Because it happened to me.
Sure.
And I've studied this. You use directed energy weapons. And you flip the bike, you know, you hit the bike wheel, it flips. Yep. And it happened to me. It was right at the worst part in the litigation. And I had I'm riding down the road. There's no wind, there's no problem, there's no, you know, everything's perfect. And suddenly my front wheel does a 90-degree turn for no reason. Boom.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I hit the dirt and I have a concussion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but I've seen lots of other people killed in bike accidents, you know, in inexplicable ways. It also happens with skiing. All of a sudden, somebody's skiing down the who was it? Bono. What was Cher's? Sonny Bono.
Sonny Bono. Yeah.
Yeah. Suddenly they ski into a tree. What?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's directed energy weapons.
Well, I think there's something definitely suspicious about his bike accident, because he was sounding like he was at least drawing back from the Ukrainian abyss in a major way, and
right.
Like you say, Victoria Nuland pulled the carpet out from under him, and this to me is a real sign that there's some factional infighting going on within the State Department, within the administration. It may be coming from the neocons versus Obama, or Obama might be lining up with the neocons. I don't know. But all the signs...
I'll tell you what it looks like to me, is you've got a group of big people with big bond positions.
Yep.
So you've got big equity positions on a variety of, you know, this is a bunch of oligarchs, but this is Western oligarchs who have huge bond positions and huge equity positions, and they've got skin in the game, and it's personal.
Yep, exactly.
You know, and Nuland works for them.
Yep.
Is my read on it.
I think you're absolutely right, because I just saw an article last week about U.S. corporations going in and buying up Ukrainian government assets. So, yeah, this sounds like Mr. Kerry stepped out of line and was slapped back into place. And I do find it very suspicious, like you, that we have hardly seen nor heard from him since the accident.
Right.
This was clearly a message that was being sent to him. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's more shenanigans as game as usual in this case. But I do think in the long term, even these crazy people have to pull back from this course, this foreign policy that they've been on, because we're alienating allies right and left. And in the long run, that's not good for their own financial health.
Well, but here's the question. Why I keep, what keeps coming into my mind is Charlie Ferguson's documentary, No Exit, about Iraq, where we basically went in and systematically destroyed the infrastructure and the civil society on purpose. And it was very similar to what I saw in the Bush administration. You know, people's idea about how you re-engineer things is you just destroy stuff on the theory that somehow you're going to magically have a new thing come together.
Right.
And the problem is you destroy the old thing, but the new thing doesn't come together because you have you basically have a situation that is defined by incoherence. So you bring incoherence, and it destroys the old thing, but nothing new gets created.
Well, this is the fundamental problem with, as far as I'm concerned, with this post-war fascist thinking, not necessarily Nazi International, but this post-war fascist thinking, because this is the classic game plan, destroy and then rebuild. But the problem is they're destroying and they're not rebuilding anything. And
right.
This is the danger that is posed by China. You know, we've got a military-industrial complex in this country that's been in place since World War II and the Cold War, and nothing has been done to shift the basis of the economy. And it's, you know, we're like an ocean liner cruising at 30 knots, and it's very hard to turn this ship around. So, you know, we've talked earlier in some of your reports about the idea that they may be retrenching, to a certain degree, manufacturing back into this country. But the problem is they're not doing it fast enough, and they're still
right.
They're still committed to this empire building. And, you know, empire building is fine if you can get everybody else to go along with it. What's happened lately is nobody else is going along with it other than maybe Israel and Andorra and some of our small.
So I just want to bring up a couple of sort of the social aspects of this. I've told this story before when I was over in Beijing in 1997, and there was a huge war at the time going on between the Clinton administration and the Chinese. And I had a PRC citizen working with me who was on the trip, and we were sitting out right next to the seat of government reading the morning paper, having our breakfast. And Henry said to me, "Do you understand what this fight is about?" And I said, "No, I really don't." And he said, "Your legislature is all lawyers, and they're saying to our legislature, do this, do this, do this, do this. And our legislature is all engineers, and they're saying, how?"
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And I think, you know, part of why everybody in Europe jumped on the Asian infrastructure bandwagon is they're tired of having lawyers tell them to do things that are not operationally feasible.
Yeah.
And a bunch of engineers said, "Let's go, you know, build a bunch of stuff." And they're like, "Yes,
exactly.
Let's get something done, you know.
Let's get something done other than dropping drones on people." Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more.
So this brings me up to another thing, because this was a pet peeve when I was in Australia. I got hit with a series of news coming out of the United States about the solution to everything is to put women in charge. So articles about how many women are now CEOs of corporations, and everyone in Australia just assumes that Hillary Clinton has been appointed, you know, president of the United States, and the solution is we put women in charge and we'll have the matriarchy and the goddess, and, you know, there's all this goddess stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I say, there was one day, because there must be something in the entrainment that gets you hating women, you know, I thought, you know, how do I get to the end of the presidential campaign and not hate women? I mean, how can I hate women? I'm a woman. How can I hate women? So I've been working on a commentary called Dressing Fascism in Skirts.
Yep.
But essentially, as they're pushing this complete, you know, sort of financial coup d'etat by regulation and trade agreement, you know, they're thinking as they burn through and destroy everything, you know, we'll just leave women in charge and then it'll be okay.
Right.
And it seems to be part of this philosophy.
Yes, it is. I think it is. It's part of the re-engineering of culture that they want to get in place. And I think part of it is Western culture has been, you know, traditionally male dominated. But my problem with any form of social engineering like that is it's usually a guise or a disguise for something else completely. And the something else in this case, I think, is more cartel socialism than anything else. It's another way of keeping people busy, looking at non-issues while they're conducting their free trade agreements in secret and so on and so forth.
Right.
So part of it, I think, is just genuine distraction. But I do agree. I think it's very clear that Hillary has been, you know, the anointed one for the next round of presidential selection.
Well, but I'm not so sure about that, and I'll tell you why. Funny thing, there are many different funny things that happened, but about 6 weeks ago was before I went down under. She and her aide on the drive to California stopped at a Chipotle for dinner, and she kept her sunglasses on and tried to be incognito. Now, if you're running for president, I mean, I appreciate that this is a person who's never been a politician. Her husband was a politician. He would no more walk into, you know, he'd walk into Chipotle and try and talk to everybody, you know,
right.
And you know, engage with everybody, whereas she would walk into Chipotle and keep her sunglasses on and try and pretend she was, you know, a customer. So, you know, but this is not the behavior of somebody who wants to be president.
Right.
Now, maybe she's figuring she's been appointed and she doesn't really have to campaign. That's knowing the Clintons, yeah. That's possible.
It could be, and it could be that you're right, that she may not really want it, that she's been told to run. And, you know, she's still got Benghazi hanging over her and all the emails and things like that. But on the other hand, you look at the Democratic Party, and they're more or less a unified picture. You look at the Republicans, on the other hand, and again, you've got this barnyard of people running.
Right.
And there doesn't seem to be any consistent vision coming out of the Republicans. You know, it's basically the same old thing. It's Democratic Party light. And so, you know, she's looking from that point of view, she's looking fairly strong.
Well, but she's got her disapproval ratings at this point are 57%.
Right.
And I got to tell you, Joseph, you cannot run. You're going to have to, you know, generally it seems to me they try and rig about 20% of the votes. So if somebody gets 40%, you need 60% to win. You can add 20%.
Right.
But I've never seen an election where they've added all 60%.
Right.
This could be it. But I think what it proves, if you look at what's happening on the Republican side or you look at what's happening on the Democratic side, both of them prove that we've reached a point where someone who's anointed by Mr. Global can come up with a package that's going to draw in popular support.
Right.
So I think the divergence is getting extraordinary, and the question is, you know, how good is their entrainment technology? I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see, and I think you're right, too. You know, we discussed this Sunday when we talked about this. Their old playbook is breaking down. It's not
working right
as well and as smoothly as it used to. So they're having to resort to more openly fraudulent methods, and those methods are themselves increasingly being exposed for being
right.
Fraudulent methods. So it's going to be a very interesting election year to see if they're able to pull it off. I think they will, but quite frankly, I think it'll be one of the last times that they're able to. There's too much popular growing global sentiment against this oligarchical rule, and they're either going to have to change their playbook and develop some very sophisticated new tools, or they're just simply going to be overwhelmed by the pace of technology and events, which is what it appears to me to be happening right now.
So let me bring up one of the topics they're going to be discussing, or two of the topics. One of the topics is artificial intelligence.
Yes.
I just finished Nick Bostrom's book. He's the professor at Oxford.
Yes.
Who writes and talks so much about, he's a Swedish philosopher about artificial intelligence. And it's quite interesting because it helps you think out what the different issues are as AI develops and where this could or could not go.
Right.
You know, a lot of it is he's engaging in high octane speculation, as you would put it, about, you know, what could happen, how it could happen. And nobody, of course, knows, but it really gets you inside of what this is and what it could do. The second thing is they're talking about cybersecurity.
Right.
Because all of their plans depend on digital systems. In essence, we're doing to the whole world what we're doing to U.S. healthcare and U.S. education, which is you standardize the human beings and put them in a, whether it's a regulatory box or a system box or a financial box, that's grossly oversimplified. It's the like 1-4 track. So you standardize the human beings to make life simple for the digital systems so you can re-engineer everything into central corporate form. And you're trying to do that with the whole planet. You're trying to do it fast, which is, of course, madness, you know, to grossly oversimplify humans so that, you know, so that machines can have an easy time.
Right.
But all of it depends on information systems. And one of the things that I can tell you, having returned from New Zealand and Australia to the United States, is our systems have no integrity.
Yes.
They are not dependable. You cannot depend on them. You know, the notion that you and I would let the, you know, the systems, you know, drive the car for us.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's different in Switzerland. All the systems are dependable, but here they're not dependable. So, you know, and now with the hacking and the cyber hacking, it's, you know, it's going off the charts. So their whole plan depends on the systems working and being able to be at least operationally trustworthy, and they're clearly not. And it's one of the places they're running into terrible problems from a variety of different parts of society, including the BRICS.
Right. Well, I don't know where to start on this one because it's such a
right.
It really is.
Well, because I will tell you perfectly honestly, whoever is running that metastructure, you put artificial intelligence in place and it gives them the ability, you know, they won't need the Bilderbergers and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bohemian
right.
Grove because they'll be able to go direct through the systems.
Right. Well, I think to a certain extent, Catherine, my
it's already happened.
It's already happened.
Right.
This is why the elite is, to my mind, acting increasingly panicked.
They're getting squeezed out.
They're getting squeezed out. The technocrats are in control. The intelligence people are in control. The high algorithm trading people are in control. In other words, you have to have the expertise to manage systems like this. You have to have the expertise even to design the architecture for them. And you and I have talked privately many times about the possibility that maybe some of these high frequency trading algorithms and dark pools have already woken up to a certain extent,
right.
And that maybe the people in the big prime banks have found evidence of this. I've strongly suspected that the reason that the bankers, so many bankers, are being suicided, is that maybe they've found evidence of something like this going on already. That, you know, they've lost control. Control is coming from somewhere outside their system, although certainly inside the system. So I do think that with the vast amount of data networking and processing that's taking place, not only with, you know, NSA spying or GCHQ spying, but simply the high volume of trades that are being conducted electronically, this is a huge data pool
right.
that companies like Google and so on are going to have access to. So the old time central bank model is simply obsolescent itself. You know, the very people putting out the obsolescence of the nation state are the very people that are already being obsolesced. Their view is obsolescent. So what this does is it puts into place a new technocracy that can very definitely be connected directly to a nation state. We see China and Russia involved in hacking and cyber attacks and so on, and they're very sophisticated at this. So, in other words, they've given a measure of soft power to their national sovereignty
right.
that the West does not have. And I think this is right. the reason you see these two things appearing at the Bilderberg agenda this year, is that they realize that they are losing their grip on their own mechanisms of power, and that they're very, very vulnerable to these types of activities. Now, there's another aspect of this we have to consider, and that's this whole hidden system of finance thing, because I think, and I'm going to spill the beans a little bit about the new book, I came to the conclusion that if you're going to have a hidden system of finance, that it can never, and this is something people are going to have to think about, it can never be cashless. It has to depend on the actual physical movement and physical exchange of some physical medium of exchange, either cash, negotiable securities, what have you. But you're also going to have some sort of mechanism to track it. And that, too, I don't think that they have, or at least they don't have one that's secure. So this, I think, is the other reason that you see this latest Bilderberg meeting hitting those two topics so high on the list, because they realize now, probably too late in the game, that their control has slipped to the intelligence agencies, their control has slipped to international corporations with the technical means to pull these types of things off, Google, Amazon,
right.
Apple, certainly some of the big European electronics firms and so on and so forth. And it slipped to those two countries that have made cyber warfare one of their principal areas of study for several decades.
Right.
So, yeah, I think this is reflective. The Bilderberg group here this year, I think, is reflecting with that discussion probably an agenda that they were told that they needed to reflect on.
Right.
Somebody ordered them. We want you to think about this and brainstorm
right.
some ideas.
Oh, I agree. And part of it is, you know, Joseph, we are coming into a tipping point where
yes.
the build-out of the Internet, you know, what is happening for a variety of reasons is an effort is being made to make sure that the Internet can access every human being on the planet.
Right.
Okay, so every human being has a smartphone, and every human being is hooked in. And
right.
when you get the build-out to 100%, even to 95%, then suddenly you have all sorts of functions that can be ubiquitous in a digital form.
Yep.
And that's when you get a level of rollout that suddenly goes exponential.
Yes.
And
yep.
and it's going to be hitting at the same time that robotics is going to be hitting.
Yes. Yes. They've got to make sure that those public systems are secure. And right now they're not. And that's their huge problem. And like I say, I think another hidden huge part of this is as we both know, there's this huge black budget hidden system squatting right in the middle of it all. And if that's
well, perhaps the trade agreements are an effort to get the corporate infrastructure in place to ride this you know sort of out of control bucking bronco.
Yeah, I definitely think that's part of the case. Absolutely, I think that's part of the case.
Okay.
Because this would explain some of the extreme secrecy around them.
They're trying to
do two things, as far as I'm concerned, Catherine. And again, I'm basing this kind of on the historical analysis that I did in the new book. They're trying to do two things. It appears to me, anyway. The first is they're trying to bypass national and regional legislatures and amalgamate law on a global basis. They're trying to come up with a uniform legal standard on the basis of regulation, particularly with respect to copyright and patents. And the latter is probably the most important thing to them,
right,
for
right,
corporate masters. But the other thing I think they're trying to do is they're trying to build out a system where you have this hidden system of finance, which is huge. I mean, you factor in international drug trade, you factor in all the bullion obfuscation that we've seen taking place in the last few years. They're trying to build a system that will keep that whole hidden system of finance secret and allow the continued physical, and I stress this point, I came to the conclusion you can't have a hidden system of finance based entirely on digital. It's going to require actual physical securities, actual physical cash, and so on and so forth that are moved around.
Right.
But you've got to be able to track that movement, and that's going to be a completely different system. So if they're trying.
See, one of my theories is the reason that the gold's been moving, they've been moving the gold around,
right,
and getting the depositories in many different places,
right,
is for security reasons.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. This, you know, I just did a blog on my website about, you know, the missing audits of the United States gold, and very clearly this is what they're doing. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, since we brought up that subject, I wouldn't be surprised that this ultimately is part of the reason that you see countries repatriating gold so quickly, is because they're doing the same thing. They're moving their gold around. It's supposed to be here, but it's really there, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and I think Mr. Global does not want it in one place.
Oh, he doesn't. He doesn't. He doesn't, because this, as far as I'm concerned, this gold, silver, things like this are the bedrock of this hidden system of finance. So, yeah, they don't want it in one place.
Yeah, it has to be. Okay, so one of the things I wanted to point out, it's very interesting to look at who's not at the Bilderberg meeting this year, but Christine Lagarde is not at the Bilderberg meeting this year.
Yep, I saw that.
Right. So the question is, why not?
Well, yeah, the question is why not, and why is Kissinger there, especially with him having been so vocal recently about American policy vis-a-vis Russia and the Ukraine. In her case, I pondered that one, and I'm speculating wildly here, Catherine, but to me, that may be an indicator of declining American influence vis-a-vis the World Bank and IMF. That may be one indicator. It may be an indicator that she's on her way out, that they're looking for somebody else that has probably a much less American point of view of things. I don't know. But, yeah, I found that very significant that she's not.
If I had to guess, I would say that things are so sensitive on a number of different issues,
yep,
that she's trying to keep a low profile.
Yep.
And her being there would – you know, they're just trying to keep her out of the camera's eye with respect to the Bilderberg meeting. They don't want Christine Lagarde on Alex Jones' homepage.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it could be any number of things. I'm still kind of inclined to the view that there's, like you say, there's so many sensitive things, but I also think that it's another measure of the declining importance of IMF and so on and so forth. And it may be that one of the things that they're going to discuss secretly there is a change in the voting procedures within the IMF. And in the
right. Well, that's a very sensitive issue.
Because yeah, absolutely.
The Americans have refused to approve,
yep,
the new group. So the question is, what do they do? And that's got to be a very quiet conversation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I think between you and me, we're probably both agreed that conversation's going to take place.
Oh, I think it's been taking place all along.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Okay, so let me bring up another sort of – it sounds a little bit tangential, but I find that that many people who come to the study of what's really happening geopolitically don't understand it, and that's what I would call special breeding programs. You know, for generations, there's always an effort to basically spread the DNA around.
Right.
If you will, and I'll never forget one person who was very knowledgeable, as a European who was very knowledgeable about World War II and had really studied it, kept trying to insist to me that George H.W. Bush was the son of an SS officer.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that.
And he pulled out a tremendous amount of documentation and pictures and other things.
Right.
And, you know, so I had no idea what to make of it. But I would say this, that it is certainly possible. In other words, if you look at how, you know, the theory is if we swap children, we're less inclined to kill each other. It's kind of a way of networking the oligarchy around the world. And I always tell the story of when I was a partner at Dillon Reed, some guy saying to me very quietly at a strategic moment, he said, you know, Douglas Dillon was adopted.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you know that, but...
know that at all.
Yeah, Clarence and his wife had gone to Switzerland. Clarence was recovering from a car accident, or very serious accident. I think it was a car accident. And they went to Switzerland for a year, and apparently Douglas was adopted in Switzerland.
Oh.
So, of course, the question is, who was Douglas Dillon?
No kidding.
Other than this... Yeah, no, but here's the thing. You know, in quiet moments, when you have the kind of jobs I had, you hear these stories. It was kind of like, remember when Madeleine Albright became Secretary of State and discovered herself that, in fact, she'd been adopted and hadn't known it?
Right.
Right. So you have these quiet swappings of DNAs going on. And one of the questions I've always had is, you know, how much of that related to the Nazi International?
Oh, I think, oh boy.
I had to open this up.
Yeah, that's another Pandora's box.
Right.
I'll put it this way. I didn't talk about that issue in the new book, and I haven't talked about it in any book. Because, number one, I'm highly suspicious that something like this was going on inside of Nazi Germany, and that the Lebensborn program, you know, their eugenics program,
right,
was more or less a smokescreen for something else that, you know, is bloodline related. However, that said,
right,
I've never been able to find any evidence. But here's the problem. You had, as you indicated, that whole IBM nexus with the Nazis, selling them computers and so on. And for that matter, you know, the Nazis had a very capable computer scientist by the name of Konrad Zuse that built German computers for them as well, that were tracking all these people in the concentration camp system. But I suspect that you also had the ability to track the major German noble families, and probably some sort of effort to track the European system, sort of a primitive digitalized Burke's peerage, so to speak.
Right.
But I have found, to be honest, Catherine, I've found no evidence. I've strongly suspected that this was going on, but I have never been able to find any evidence to that effect.
Well, this is, of all the secrets I've ever dealt with, this, you know, by the families involved, is quiet. It's one of the big ones, but it's quiet, 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 quiet. Nobody mentions it. And one of the reasons is, you know, nobody wants to hurt each other's feelings when they discover who they really are.
Right.
And one of the reasons I keep thinking about it is, you know, to go back to IBM. IBM, you know, runs, basically provides the database technology and computing power for the Holocaust. We now have IBM doing the database technology and systems for the census, the smart meters, and all sorts of other sort of home and residential related. They're the ones with Watson, the huge artificial intelligence, you know, behemoth. And at the same time, we have an effort by a variety of parties to map the DNA and get everybody to voluntarily get their DNA mapped. And you're thinking that all goes, sucks up into that database.
Yep.
And it's almost as though they want to be able to understand who everybody really is.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I have suspected, and I think I've mentioned this on a couple of our other sessions before, I have suspected for a very long time, Catherine, that the whole genome project had as one of its covert agendas or goals to map and discover what the real facts were about all of these bloodline families. I've suspected that for many, many years. Now, I recently found very interesting confirmation that this may, to some extent, be true on a small scale, in that I found that the Sinclair family, the Sinclair clan, members of that clan are engaged publicly in trying to collect data, and they're asking people with the last name of Sinclair to send their DNA and blah, 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 so that they can figure out, you know, what the genome actually is in the family. So that's one example that we have of a bloodline family that is public about the fact that some of its members are doing this. So you get all of these sudden stopping points that are appearing in this country where people are having their DNA swabbed and so on and so forth. Yeah, they're building a database. And my suspicion is that they're not just building it for the purposes of some sort of biowarfare thing. They're trying to find something about the human genome. They're looking for something.
Oh, I also think they're trying to figure out who's who.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They want to find the hidden members of their bloodlines.
Right. And I have to tell you, I think it's very important not to be in the database.
I would totally agree. I think they're trying to find, you know, I talked about this way back in the Cosmic War and the indications in some of the ancient Mesopotamian texts that if those things were referring to a technology, every indication is that this technology was biometrically activated. So that would be one reason you'd want to try and find some of this ancient DNA, is if you're going to recover that technology, you have to have the biometric signature that allows it to work. If my wild and hairy speculation is true. So, you know, there's all sorts of possible agendas going on. I think it's highly unusual that you have the Nazis setting up really the first attempt at a DNA database, so to speak, with their computerized systems. And I suspect, again, that this was heavily involved with their Lebensborn program. I suspect it was heavily involved with some of the Annenerbe research that was being done by the SS. But again, I found no evidence to document that hypothesis beyond a mere suspicion.
Okay, well, several more things I want to cover before we close. One is, it seems to me, because I agree with you, I think things have, you know, with the global rebalancing of the economy and what we started in the 90s, mm-hmm. It's kind of like we set off a tsunami economically and culturally, and it's running away. It's got its own dynamic, and a lot of the leadership is kind of... You know, the old tricks aren't working. One of the things I have to point out is one of the attendees is Jim Johnson.
Yes.
And another attendee is the campaign manager, the number one fundraiser for Hillary Clinton. And I just want to go back in time. Jim Johnson, when the housing bubble was engineered in the 90s under the Clinton administration, Jim Johnson was the chairman of Fannie Mae. I know because he used to be a friend of mine, and I have lots of Jim Johnson stories. And, of course, the Clintons were in the White House, and Jim Johnson was at Fannie Mae, and they were off to the races. And it was extraordinary. I remember I was looking at the FHA strategic plan when the FHA commissioner was negotiating with Freddie and Fannie to radically increase their credit in low-income communities. And at the same time, I saw the new FHA strategic plan, which was also planning on radically increasing its credit in low-income communities. And I said, I turned to one of the top officials and I said, look, this is impossible. People are going to have to refinance their mortgage twice a year from prison to make these numbers. And the person looked at me and said, shut up, this is none of your business. So I can assure you that the Treasury and the White House and Jim Johnson over at Fannie Mae were quite clear. Now, it's interesting. So Hillary's fundraiser is going to be there. Jim Johnson's going to be there. The administration is doing extraordinary things to juice the housing market. I just did a new commentary up on the blog about called Juicing the Real Estate Market. So they're planning on, you know, this is what they know how to do. And they're planning on doing it again.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like the gang's all here. So I looked at the Bilderberg list and I thought, oh, great. The people who brought you the housing bubble. Here we go again. But anyway, so I agree with you that we've set off a dynamic. The game's running ahead of everybody. And with things like artificial intelligence and the cyber hackings, it's getting a little scary. But in that fluidity, there's opportunity. Because I think, you know, as the world looks at the way this is evolving and says, this is really not adult.
Right.
You know, you're giving children powerful technology and they're behaving like kids. They're not behaving like adults. So you see this aversion, and that's an opportunity.
Yes.
So it's an opportunity to shift things. So what do we do? How do we take advantage of the opportunity?
Well, you know, I'm not a financial expert or anything, but my personal approach, Catherine, has been to look back at the period of the German hyperinflation between the wars. And what you saw was a very interesting thing going on, and I've been kind of applying this, and that is to own things. Because what they were doing in Germany with the hyperinflation, you had people buying all sorts of, they were buying land, they were buying houses, they were buying artworks and so on and so forth. In other words, they were buying things that they could barter.
Right.
And I this has been kind of my approach since I saw all of this personally happen, you know, back in 2008 with the bailouts. I thought, trouble's coming. I better own something.
Whiskey and brooms is what.
Exactly. You know, I up to that point, I had not thought about owning a house or any property or anything like that. But after that point, I thought, you know, debt may not be so bad in terms of a mortgage or a little plot of land or something, because the problem is now that there's such a loss of confidence in the public system and such a cynicism in the institutions of government because, you know, for all intents and purposes, they're not our institutions of government anymore. They're the corporations. So I figured if I'm going to have any sort of minuscule amount of clout beyond my books, I have to own physical things. That doesn't necessarily make me a gold bug, but, you know.
But where's the opportunity? Where's the opportunity for us to – because, you know, we can't protect ourselves one by one.
Right.
We have to shift the whole state of play. So I'm much more ambitious. And I think there is a way. It's what you said in the fall. We have to preserve Western civilization.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We have an opportunity with the internet to make the classics and to discuss the classics and to implement in our families and in our and even, let me put it this way, even to create institutions. They may be ad hoc, they may be informal, but to create institutions that discuss, that plan, that do things on a community basis. And this is not being done. but it needs to be done. I was kind of dumbfounded that I've got a couple of groups that I've been told about that meet and do nothing but discuss my works. You know, I'd rather they discuss Plato or something, but, you know, nonetheless, there are groups doing this sort of thing. Well, if we can take that idea and expand it to like-minded individuals in our locality where we are,
right.
Because the other thing I'm seeing is, with the internet and social media, we're not in communities anymore. Our communities are all online, they're all electronic, but how many of us know the name of one or two of our neighbors that we live next to?
Right.
You know, I think something like this has to be done. If it's nothing more than saying hello to the neighbor lady and you know, how are you,
right.
making sure she's okay and so on and so forth. But we have to get back to this. And the other thing we absolutely have to start doing, I don't care what it is, we have to hold people accountable. We cannot have a system of rampant corruption and expect things to go on. There has to be rule of law. And it has to be for everybody. We can't have a privileged class.
Right.
So we've got to start talking about these things and putting it out there and eventually figuring out how we're going to enforce it. Because if there's anything that we've learned from the last 15 years, our civilization is collapsing precisely because there's no rule of law.
There's no law.
Right.
And it's more than just that. There's no accountability in the sense of,
yeah.
You know, what you're seeing is the people who, you know, so you're seeing the people who engineered the last housing bubble, you know, running for president.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's like, well, I guess we made a lot of money on that, so now we can run for president with it. And, you know, so you're watching zero accountability being held up and crime pays. So
right.
The message is day by day by day, crime pays. And it was interesting. Even The Economist wrote an article called, it was the cover story, America's Aristocracy is Calcifying. And they basically ended it by complaining that a Bush and a Clinton were running for president and saying, you know, how mediocre that was. Yeah, it is. And it was quite extraordinary because here you have, you know, the official organ of the Anglo-American Alliance saying,
exactly.
This is pathetically mediocre and we object.
Yeah, exactly. And they're right to. But, you know, this, in a certain sense, Catherine, and we've talked about this before, the oligarchs within the Anglosphere, within the Western system, have become calcified. And the reason is that they've sponsored their think tanks, they've given their foundation money to people that all think exactly like them. So in other words, you couldn't get Bill Gates or a David Rockefeller to think anything else other than the box that they've put themselves into. And this is why these Bilderberg meetings, CFR things, they're going to go the way of the dodo bird. Because if you get a group of people that have been thinking the same way together for 70 years, they're not going to be able to deal with anything.
Right.
You know, so the other thing I think that is absolutely crucial that we need to start doing is we need to restore historical memory. This is something that has been lost.
Yes, I agree.
We see the same people that were responsible for the previous housing bubble getting right back in there, getting ready to pull the same thing again. So we need to use the tools available to us, every one of us, the internet and so on, and start putting out the memory and the track record of who these people are, these so-called elites, and what they've done.
Right.
Just keep hammering it and making this a consistent part of public memory, of institutional memory. The other thing I think that eventually we're going to have to do is we're going to have to put together our own sort of independent think tanks to not only invite people of a particular point of view, but people of an opposite point of view, and just, you know,
right.
Have open freewheeling discussions. Bilderberg
right.
meetings, Chatham House rules, and all of this stuff that these groups have cloaked themselves with are not going to make it and not going to work for one very simple reason, and that is they have no public accountability. And this is the other thing that I think is necessary. We're going to have publicly accountable think tanks of people that are ready and willing to do the high octane speculation and think outside the box.
You
can't look to the current academy, particularly in this country. You can't look to these foundations and think tanks. We're going to have to set up parallel structures. They may at first be informal, but set them up with the recognition that they may grow, they may morph, and invite open discussion. This is not what's happening. Universities are gatekeepers for historical narratives and orthodoxies, and so are the foundations in these big think tanks. So
I have to tell you a very interesting example. When I'd had a series of efforts in the mid-90s as the feds to try and falsely frame us. And I think I don't think it started with feds. I think that one of the defense contractors and a group of private people, you know, falsified information, gave it to the government, got the thing going. And when it didn't work, you know, the government tried to come up with more, you know, so they kind of stalemated. And at that point, I had had lawyers who were not my choice stuffed in to represent me by the insurance company. The lawyers came to me and asked me to record all my recollections of working in the Bush administration. I later found out many years from an insider that they had decided, well, we can't frame her on anything she did after leaving the administration. Let's frame her for something she did during the administration. And so this was going to be the inside dope they used to get me. Well, of course, naive me, I just make 6 90-minute cassettes and give them to the attorneys. Well, the first thing that happens, then they went ballistic. Everybody wanted to listen to them, to my shock and amazement. We finally had to put them up on the internet because we made so many copies, but they just went viral. The first thing that happened was several people who I'd worked with suddenly disappeared from the public scene. And I was told later their careers were ruined. And I think what happened was you got a group of people over at the CIA listening to these tapes, and they had no idea. They had no idea what was really going on downstairs. And these tapes gave them a view into reality, and it was a total shock to them. They had no idea. And so instead of the tapes being used to frame me, because there was nothing to frame me on, you know, it basically destroyed a couple of, you know, former and potential cabinet people. And one of the things I believe is you don't tell stories out of school. I would never have made those tapes if the attorneys hadn't sort of insisted.
Right.
So
right.
The funny thing was they got hung on their own petard. And, but I think it was an enormous education. And I think, you know, it's very interesting. Many times I will have people who think of themselves as a member of elites come and complain to me that the human race or these people or that people are acting stupid. And what I realize is they have not a clue what those people's context and circumstances and why they're behaving the way they're behaving. You know, and I keep telling them, look, if I was in their shoes, I'd do the exact same thing. Here's why it's logical, blah, blah, blah. And what I realize is they don't, you know, their ignorance of reality is profound.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They live in their own virtual reality, and they want everybody else to live in their own virtual reality. And the other problem you just pointed out is they've got the American federal government, at least, is so large that it doesn't even know what it's doing anymore. You know, you can get away with corruption on a rampant scale simply because it is so large, and you know, a few key people
right.
in a few key places can pull off all sorts of things. You know, just look at 9/11.
Well, here was the problem. The problem is, as you centralized, the people who rose to power, the people who'd say sure and go along, and you had a lot of productivity in the system, which was fat you could live off of. But as those people get forced out, you know, so Kerry's a perfect example. What we're watching is another productive guy, Hagel, was, you know, they're getting forced out. And as the grounded people, the productive people get forced out, the system becomes more and more fragile and more ridiculous.
Yep. This is why, It is so fragile now, Catherine, that I think it's absolutely essential that we have to restore historical memory.
Right.
We have to challenge the orthodox narratives of history that we've been fed. We have to establish independent thinking bodies. Let's not call them think tanks right now, because that has bad connotations. But at least
think networks.
Yeah,
think networks.
Yeah, that's a good phrase for it. Think networks.
Right.
That do this and do it on just more than simply an accidental basis. That target certain things and so on. You know, I do attempt to, as you do on your website, attempt to target certain areas. Broad areas for continual commentary. And, you know, it's interesting to see the response that people get, because it gets them thinking and digging and looking in other areas and so on and so forth. So I think this is a part of it. And eventually institutions will have to come out of all of this that are alternatives to these, you know, heritage foundations, Brookings Institutes, and so on and so forth, that have been giving us the same swill for decades. And now we're in a situation in the world where their solutions aren't working, and they can't think of any other solutions because they're thinking of any other solutions.
They've lost, you know, the line is so blurred between advocacy and reality that they don't understand reality anymore.
No, they don't. They don't.
Well, the one thing before we close, I have two more things. One is, we got asked a question, and I promised that I would, for one subscriber, put the question to you. They were saying, and it's a little bit related, but not completely, that you and I were saying that, you know, we haven't had hyperinflation because of a variety of reasons. And the questioner said, well, wait a minute, what about the inflation in the housing and stock market bubble?
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to address that with you. And let me start by saying that a rise in price coming from monetary inflation. So let's say we have a real asset of a real estate trust that's trading in the stock market.
Right.
As you debase the currency, the price and the value goes up, only because the value of the currency you're pricing in it goes down.
Right.
So it's not that the value is increasing, it's just that the currency is debasing. That's different than a bubble. A bubble is when values go up way above their market value.
Right.
So there's a difference between bubbles and debasement, because I don't think in many respects they're different parts of these markets are bubbled. I think they're simply reflecting pricings that are debased. So I just want to say that first. But what we were talking about was the fact that labor deflation coming from globalization and from new technology is offsetting, you know, it's soaking up a lot of the monetary inflation and basically spreading the dollars around more and more places and countries and population is also helping do that, as is the digital control. So I don't know if you wanted to say anything about inflation, but I know we've had many people believing that there's hyperinflation coming, and it hasn't come.
I totally agree with you. We do have to distinguish between bubbles and inflation. And, you know, like you say, we're looking at perhaps another round of it coming up. But yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. I mean, I'm four square with you there. I go back to the fundamental problem that if there was going to be hyperinflation, we should have seen it by now. And again, you know, this, and I've said this many, many times before, we have heard these predictions of hyperinflation since Nixon took us off Bretton Woods. And it's kind of like rapture predictions, you know. You know, and this is what I mean by historical memory. We're hearing the financial analysts putting out all this hyperinflation talk. We've been hearing it for years now, since the bailouts, if not before. And my point is, we've been hearing it really since Nixon, if not since the establishment of the Federal Reserve. And obviously, yeah, the currency has been debased since that occurred, but We have not seen sudden hyperinflation that everybody's been predicting.
Well, we've seen slow burn inflation. So
yeah, exactly.
Our incomes are declining and our expenses are rising.
Right.
The other thing he asked about, which I think is really good, was the he asked about both peak oil and peak I call it peak everything.
Right.
I was at a gold conference in New Orleans, and somebody asked Jim Rogers about peak oil, and he said, "Forget peak oil; it's peak everything."
Well, yeah, exactly.
Right, and but the reality is, we have more and more people, and we're stripping the planet of its resources, and that is a big problem.
Well, I've always taken issue with the idea of peak anything. Because let's just look at one of the memes of Mr. Global, and that's, you know, carrying capacity or overpopulation or whatever you wish to call it.
Uh-huh.
And I go back to the point that the idea of a maximum carrying capacity for the planet was first put out in Venice. It was put out in the 17th century, I think it was. Giovanni Ortiz, a fellow that came up with the idea. So in other words, long before Malthus did it, they were talking about this in Venice. So whenever I hear overpopulation, the first thing I think is, corrupt financial oligarchy seeking to maintain its own power. And the problem with these things is we need to remember that nothing is set in stone. There was a time when petroleum was worthless. What made it valuable was the advent of technologies that could use it. And the same thing with carrying capacity. This changes with the ability of technology to offset population growth and so on. And you know, peak oil, I've never been a believer in the idea that this is a fossil fuel.
Right.
I'm definitely of the abiotic theory on oil, and let's remember that it was actually the Rockefeller interest that put out the idea that oil is a fossil fuel, namely that it was a very scarce, rare resource and so on and so forth. So, you know, I do think, you know, we may be approaching peak corruption and things like that. But,
well, I will say this. I was, Australia is 90% of the U.S. landmass.
Right.
And they have 25 million people, and, you know, it feels a lot more wonderful to have those kind of open spaces. So we're kind of pressing in on each other in places.
Well, yeah, excuse me. I'm from the Midwest. And, you know, I've driven all over the Midwest from Texas to Wyoming and Montana and so on and so forth. And every time I hear overpopulation as I'm driving between downtown metropolitan Lusk, Wyoming, and I'm thinking, what are they talking about?
Well, they're talking about the fact that a lot of the population is being moved into cities.
Exactly.
So the cities are growing, the rural areas are being stripped everywhere around the planet.
Yeah. And, you know, if we're going to start talking about things like this, what we really need to start talking about is, do we really need these great, big, sprawling megalopolises? And
right.
The answer is no. I think they're very obsolete, as a matter of fact. I grew up in a city in South Dakota that at the time was not even 100,000 people, and we had all the amenities of New York City. And, you know, why would anyone, therefore, want to live in New York City and pay through the nose to do so? I think we really have to look at, do we really need to pack more and more people into these sprawling megalopolises? And the answer is no, because I think the technology of the big city, given what's happening now with internet, with new forms of distribution and online shopping and so on and so forth, these great big sprawling cities are as obsolete as the dodo bird. So it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's not the nation state that's obsolete, it's the huge city that's obsolete.
Right.
So, you know, we need to start adjusting our thinking. We need to look at other ways to approach these types of problems. Or do we have overpopulation? Well, yeah, in New York City we do. In China, we do. But in
24 million people. Yeah.
Okay,
let's talk about debt. Our first quarter wrap-up was planetary debt, and we looked at the continued explosion of debt around the world, including now the developing world as well.
Right.
40 countries with over 100% debt to GDP. So what's the end game on this? Because clearly the debt has been, you know, part of the inflation is you print money and you pile it up in the fixed income market. So if the planet is a house, you know, we have a $1 million house and $1 million trading in the equity markets and a $100 million mortgage.
Yeah.
Kind of floating along in the fixed income market. And the big issue, of course, in the capital markets right now is if interest rates start to rise, which they're doing in Europe and here, you know, the only place interest rates are coming right down right now is in Russia. If interest rates start to rise, where's all that money going to go? You could have enormous inflation in the housing and equity markets if it crashes up. Of course, it could go the other way. What was the goal here? What's the end game?
I'm going to crawl way out onto the end of the twig of way beyond graphs and charts and so on. And what I think is going on is a philosophical battle at the very highest echelons. There is a school of thought out there that the debt now is so massive on a global basis, it can never be repaid.
Right.
And that's a spiritual situation. Because if that's the case, then what do you do? So the other part...
So let me just stop you for a question.
Sure.
Because the question is, who holds the debt?
Exactly.
And so my question is, are all the holders of the debt human and on Earth?
yeah, that's precisely where I was going. I crawling way out onto the very tip of the twig now.
Okay.
I suspect that there is a possibility that not all the holders are on this planet. There's an old statement by Charles Fort to the effect that, you know, we are owned by somebody, that we're property, and they're not here on this planet.
Well, there's a wonderful scene. I don't know if you've seen Jupiter. I think it's Jupiter Rising,
right,
or Jupiter Ascending. There's one point where one off-planet oligarch screams at the, you know, the person from Earth, look, you're a very small part of a very big corporation.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So I suspect that it may be that this is the case. Now, if that's the case, let's go back to our breakaway civilization thinking for a moment. Because as I put it in the Secret Space Program talk, the first one I did, the post-war American national security apparatus had three problems that they were confronted with, that they had to deal with all at once. And that was, of course, the communist bloc, then indications of this surviving Nazi organization, and finally UFOs. And I suspect that they took the decision that, you know, if they were thinking in terms of ancient history, possible visitors from off-planet, and the connection between the two, that they were thinking, well, by golly, this time around, we're just going to go it alone. We're going to stand for human independence and sovereignty. All right, if this is the case, then we have to consider the possibility that this piling up of huge amounts of debt is simply the prelude to pressing a reset switch, to doing what the ancient Sumerians did with the so-called ceremony of the breaking of the tablets, where the king would come out and ceremonially break tablets of debt. In other words, void all current contracts and indebtedness, and
right,
simply wipe it all off the slate. They could be getting ready to do that, and it would be a perfect situation to bring in a new global currency system that was not based on the idea of debt. And in order to do that, in order to make any such system like that work, not saying that you're getting rid of the idea of debt altogether, it's just what you're getting rid of, pardon me, is the idea of monetized debt functioning as money. if that's what the game is, if big underlining on that word if here, folks, if that's what they're up to, then the other thing that you would need to make such a financial system work are completely different types of energy technologies.
Right.
Energy technologies like fusion, cold fusion, some technology to tap into the zero-point energy and so on. And lo and behold, you know, what's very interesting to me is we keep seeing these stories coming out one after the other in little odd places where they are talking about these energy technologies and so on. And even the Bilderberg Group a few years back made fusion one of its major topics of discussion. So, you know, they are getting ready for something. I think they're getting ready for something big financially, a reset possibly, like I've been talking about. But to do this, they've got to have a different energy system.
Right.
So this energy system is reliant on technologies that, if put into or allowed into the wrong hands, would be terribly potentially destructive. So
right.
The other thing you need is a global surveillance.
Tight control.
So they're
right.
Yeah, exactly. So they're, you know, putting all these dots together. That's what it looks like to me.
Well, one of the things, one possibility is this explosion of debt is really an entrapment system.
Yep.
To then put everyone over a barrel so that you can re-engineer to this global system that's being introduced through things like the trade agreements.
Yep.
And part of that, of course, you're right, is the energy technology. So you're trying to get enough centralized control and enough global systems so you can run an entirely different platform for currency, for energy, for all these different things. But of course, you can't tell anybody. And I think if you look at those seven secretaries of Treasury who are writing the letter saying you've got to do TPP, you know, basically they're representing the bond market.
Yep. And the question is why? And, you know, I go back to a fundamental thing here is if you're going to put into play a global government, the question is, why do you need one? We've been working pretty well without one for a long time, but very clearly there are people that want one, and the question is why. And I don't think it's just simply to feather their own power, because, you know, it's bad enough running a country the size of the United States. Imagine running the whole planet. You know, I wouldn't want the job. I don't know anybody sane that would. So, in other words, exactly. You know,
right.
So in other words, there's an external factor here that seems to be in play, at least to my mind. And you need a global coordination if you are under some sort of potential threat. And that is the bottom line for me. I think this is what's driving things in secret. They need all of this for something that they may know is imminent, and we've got to put it into place as fast as we can. And that's the way they've been acting.
Right.
They're
yeah, scary. I agree. Okay, well, as you can see, our situation, whether locally or globally, is fluid. Is that fair to say? Uncertain, but fluid.
Very uncertain.
We're willing.
Very fluid.
We're willing for everything to turn out just fine. Anyway, so opportunity abounds. So the last thing I want to talk about is I want to go over again your book. Because I have pre-ordered it twice, because I want to make sure I get it.
I want that book.
I'm taking no chances. And but it is available for pre-order. We can find it through your website or through Amazon.
Yes.
Correct? And give us the name and just give us a quick quip about it.
The new book is called The Third Way. The subtitle is The European Union, the Nazi International, and Corporate Fascism. It's a book that I had planned a long time ago to do. In fact, some of the research that appears in this book I did when I was writing Nazi International, but I decided not to use it in that book because it was simply – it was going to make it unwieldy, and it functions better in this book. But I wrote it in response to questions I keep getting from people. Where is this group now, and what are they up to? And I point out that the logical implication, if you've been following what I've put out in previous books, is that it's in Europe. that's still the power base for it, and it's still doing the same old thing. It should be out in mid-July, if my publisher just sent me an email today, said that that's the possibility. Basically, in it, I examine German war aims from World War I and World War II. I show the consistency of them. I examine German policy vis-a-vis Islam, which has also been remarkably consistent since the Kaiser. I toss out the hypothesis that maybe this war on terror really isn't a war on terror. Maybe it's a war on...
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Oh, you've got to get Islam into the Western banking interest, pro-interest model.
Yep, exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This has been a consistent part of the German foreign policy arsenal since the Kaiser. I point out the technological interests, and there's just a lot of new stuff in this book. It begins with a bang and ends in controversy. So,
well, you know, I'm really happy that it's on pre-order because it gives me something to look forward to. And this is a world where you need to have something to look forward to. So this will give me something to look forward to until early August. So you've got to start working on a new one by early August.
Oh, I've already started working on the new one. I've been reading research for the new one.
Okay. Well, that's good because we always need something to look forward with. Dr. Joseph Farrell, I can't tell you how much energy you bring to all of our worlds. We appreciate it. You are you are a thinking network in and of yourself.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me back on, Catherine.
Okay. Have a wonderful evening, and we'll be talking to you next quarter.
All right. You too.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.